Basic Brewing Radio is sponsored in part by the American Home Brewers Association. Learn how to ferment mustard, make pickled peppers, and bake the best boule with a free copy of The Fermentation Kitchen by Gabe Toth. Use promo code KITCHEN to join or renew your American Home Brewers Association membership by September 30th to claim your free book, a $19.95 value. Visit homebrewersassociation.org/basicbrewing to download a free recipe from the Fermentation Kitchen to learn more about this limited-time offer. homebrewersassociation.org/basicbrewing, promo code KITCHEN. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, September 8th, 2022. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Brian Welsbacher, author of Oklahoma Beer, A Handcrafted History, talks about the challenging history of beer in the Sooner State and how homebrewing and homebrewers helped shape it into what it has become today. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. And if you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs and our brewer's logbooks. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing, and find our show page on Facebook as well. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. And many thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. This week, financial supporters will be seeing an early release of the second video episode that Steve and I shot the other day. This one is about Steve's Kvik Pale Ale, deliciously hoppier than the first beer that we tried that day. That was my it was a cream ale, that's right, fermented with Kvik at basement temperatures. That beer is gone now. It was a delicious beer. Now it's gone. That was a fun day. Steve and I got together yesterday to record an audio show featuring sort of off-the-wall tinctures. Five tinctures for a dark beer that you might not think of. It was really fun. That's coming up in a couple of weeks on this program. This upcoming Saturday, Steve and I are planning to be in the parking lot of our friends and sponsors Desiree and Dave of High Gravity in Tulsa for the Tulsa Craft Beer Invitational. You might remember Susan and I went last year and had a lot of fun, recorded a lot of interviews, tasted some delicious beers. Desiree has been posting some really fun-looking beers on social media that will be featured at the Invitational. For example, Cedar Canyon Blackberry Sour from Scissor Tail Brewing Company, Coco Loco Imperial Stout from the Nook Brewing Company, and Mango Wholesome Wheat from Lost Street Brewing Company. I don't recognize some of these brewery names that she's posting, so I'm hoping that we get to sample breweries that we haven't met before. So if you're in the neighborhood, you should get tickets at TCBI Beer. That's Tulsa Craft Beer Invitational, TCBI.beer. And while you're in the parking lot of High Gravity, you should stock up on homebrew ingredients and check out the Warthog Electric Systems in person, along with the standalone controllers. And of course, you can always find High Gravity and all the wonderful things at highgravitybrew.com. That's highgravitybrew.com. One of the bits of good news that I've been forgetting to tell you about, a few weeks ago, you may remember Greg McGill down in New Zealand wrote me saying he's going to be in the Chicago area next summer and wanted to get in touch with Ken Kazmierski, the brewer of the hot dog beer that Steve and I sampled and loved so much at HomebrewCon. Well, I called out to Ken to write me, and he did. So we were able to make a trans-global beer connection, and I'm hoping that Greg and Ken will be able to meet in person and share some beers. And if the stars align, maybe I can tag along too. Fingers crossed. Stay tuned for more details on the hot dog beer meetup. I don't know what you workshop that. In the meantime, let's talk to Brian Welsbacher, author of Oklahoma Beer, about the rocky history of brewing in the Sooner State. Brian Welsbacher, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Well, thanks for having me today.
You and I met in person, and you were kind enough to sign your book for me at High Gravity in Tulsa. Some friends and I were in town for an Elvis Costello concert and dropped by. Of course, we've always got to go by Pippin's Tap Room and see what's on tap and give Desiree a big hug. But it was good to meet you in person. And that was a long time ago. And I apologize for taking this long to get back to you. There was Homebrew Con in the midst and all kinds of stuff going on. So I read your book and it's very interesting. Oklahoma has, I hate the term most unique, but it certainly is one of the more interesting stories as far as beer and alcohol is concerned, and I want to get into that. But tell us a bit about yourself, and you've got another, besides being a beer author, you've got another beer-related gig, right?
Yeah, you know, it kind of ties in with, I moved here in 2008 from Illinois. Just across the river from St. Louis. And so, you know, there you have a prolific beer culture. And then coming down here to a state where you can't even buy alcohol on Sundays was a real eye opener. And so, one, I kind of like, what the hell is I doing? But, you know, two, you're in love. So you just kind of go where that goes, right? And so my wife had come down here for a job and we eventually just put roots down. So, but while I was doing that, I just kind of gotten into the local beer culture as well and kind of wanted to get together like-minded enthusiasts. And so I created a company called Beer is Okay. And what I did was made a bottle opener in the shape of Oklahoma. And so the panhandles, right, where you pry off the bottle.
Oh.
And kind of just started my company with that. And then just, you know, as time went on, blogging became a thing. So you blogged about it because no one else was really doing that much of it. And then podcast became a thing. So you podcast for a little while. And I kind of gathered a good oral history of people around me that, you know, started all these breweries in Tulsa and Oklahoma City. And while I was doing that, I have a background in graphics and graphic design, kind of got into, you know, doing my own beer themed, beer inspired design work. And so, if you go to beerisokay.com, you can see all of my crazy, wacky ideas that are Oklahoma inspired and now kind of like nature and beer inspired as well. So just been having fun with that and also branched out and do a lot of artwork for breweries with labels and branding and logos and things like that lately. So
cool.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of beer being made in Oklahoma right now.
There is. There's a lot more. I just got done. This past weekend, we had the Oklahoma Craft Beer Summit in Tulsa. And so met several new breweries in the works. And it was a great week or great Saturday. We're just kind of getting to meet people and, you know, some good panels of discussion with current brewers and, you know, a good place for people to, you know, bounce ideas and get some inspiration for starting more breweries, you know, outside of, you know, the main hubs of Tulsa and Oklahoma City.
Cool. And when I'm airing this this episode, the following weekend will be the Tulsa Craft Beer Invitational in the parking lot of High Gravity. And you're going to be there as well.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Set up and hawking my wares and hanging out and drinking beer.
And signing books, I'm assuming.
And signing books if anybody wants one. Yeah, that's true.
Well, it is a really interesting book. It Oklahoma in the beginning was very progressive in the way of progressing prohibition before anybody else in the country. It was a rocky start for alcohol and for beer. Talk about that. I mean, how. Why was it so bad and how bad was it?
Yeah. So, you know, and what I do in the book is kind of preface the history of the statehood itself, because without that, you don't understand why so many laws and liquor laws were the way they were. So, you know, Oklahoma was before statehood was, you know, being an Indian territory mostly. So fast forward a few more years, you had the land run. and you had all these people. It was really one of the last Wild Wests in the country, because there was not a lot of law, and you had people running liquor between states, up from Texas and then through Kansas, that was actually going in prohibition at the time. But you know, with Oklahoma, the founding of Oklahoma City and budding and rising, you actually had three different breweries at the time that most people, even myself included, didn't know until I researched it. And it was pretty fascinating because, you know, as the rail moved west, and I always preface this, there's a great book by author Maureen Ogle. She did the American brewing history, but what I learned there was, you know, most of the Northeast was, you know, pretty dominated by, you know, Bud Miller at the time, sorry. And then, you know, everybody's moving west, and, you know, Adolphus Busch even had stakes in different breweries in Texas and almost in Oklahoma too. So it kind of made sense that it was the migration of beer and production throughout the West. And so, you know, Oklahoma had a bit of it, but you also had at the time the temperance movements, and the big thing, beer just got looped into all alcohol, unfortunately, because you had the big problems with saloons and, you know, alcoholics rampant throughout the country, and people are trying to put a stop to it, which eventually became, you know, national prohibition. But Oklahoma became a state in 1907 with prohibition written in. So they didn't have a chance from the start. You know, and that's kind of the cliffs notes of it. But it is. It's just like they just, as much as, you know, these places like Oklahoma Ice and Brewing Company and New State Brewing Company, they all tried, and they were, you know, they all have the same advertising as, you know, beer back then was more of a health drink than a, you know, intoxicating drink. So,
right.
You know, and there was always those arguments too, of like, what is an intoxicating drink? And it's all, you know, just to, like today, all in the language of how you say it and market something.
We're big fans of Maureen Ogle and her, her book. She's been on the show a couple of times.
Awesome.
And she writes about people testifying that they could drink, you know, so many beers and not get drunk.
Yeah.
You know, therefore beer was a temperance beverage.
Yeah, that was crazy. Like, some guy kept claiming like 30 some beers or 50 some beers. Like, you're full of, you know, he's full of
it. Literally.
Yeah.
So it was a rocky start for the state, mm-hmm. as far as beer was concerned. But one thing I liked about the book was that homebrewing, and this is a podcast about homebrewing. Homebrewing is a constant throughout the whole story, mm-hmm. and people were brewing a specific kind of beer unique to Oklahoma, called Chock. Mm-hmm. And I talked to Michael Lally of mm-hmm. Krebs Brewing Company, and he was, you know, he produced, do they still make Chock?
In some version, it's usually, I think it's more just down in Krebs and McAllister area, because I have not really seen it outside of there since, you know, since they've taken Prairie on. So,
Michael was a little vague about what Chock was in the beginning, mm-hmm. Because it was made, you know, by so many people, and everybody mm-hmm. had probably had their own recipe, but mm-hmm. but there was sugar and a pillowcase involved. And can you give us kind of a guide to what Chock, Choc was?
Yeah, you know, I always tell people when I was doing this, I was like, that brand or that story has its own book in itself that needs to be written, because it is a fascinating story, and I touch on it in the second chapter. That you're right, there was, and just like most other places, there were around the U.S. there were immigrants that came through, and there was the mining town down in McAllister and Krebs. There was tons of land to be mined, and there was the Pigari family, which was down there, and the most famous person was Pietro, who later renamed himself Pete. You know, as a young kid, just try, you know, he was about, I think, 11, working the mines, just trying to support his family, and broke his leg, and then had to kind of do other things. And I think, you know, as most immigrant families, you have, you know, people have their own recipes for bread and things of this nature. And it was the same with winemaking and beer making and such. And that was kind of ingrained in them already. So, you know, they, the lore of the story was, you know, as he got older, he learned of how to homebrew, and, you know, the local, Indian, tribes there had, supposedly given him some wheat and taught them how to make this supposedly chalk beer because of the Choctaw Indians that were there. So that's kind of where that all came up. It was, it, that story alone is still, like, you know, they say hazy because there's no direct, like, proof, but that's just what's been handed down over the decades. And so he gets into that, and chalk becomes kind of this, and so it gets spread throughout the community. It's not just his, it gets its own moniker of, like, you know, almost in quotes, the CHOC, chalk beer. And because, yeah, so many people use so many random ingredients, like reading from the book here, you know, it was a drink readily made from such conglomerations as malt, cornmeal, and raisins, and other extreme ingredients like axle grease, just to give it a kick. I mean, people literally just died from drinking it or went crazy. It was almost like bath salts back in the day.
Yeah,
it was, so there was a lot of, obviously, a lot of big crackdowns on chalk houses where people would make it and sell it, and which was what Pete was kind of doing eventually. And his family was big, Italian family's big into cooking. And so he eventually had his restaurant and sold chalk beer there as well. Well, I guess he kind of skirted, he did go to jail several times for it, like most other people did, but he kind of got a name for himself by, you know, actually serving local law enforcement or judges and lawyers and things like that. So he just, it just kind of got to a point where it's like, you just keep it on the down low, and like, everybody's happy, not, you know, nobody's doing anything bad. It's like, just kind of keep it chill. But yeah, most other chalk joints, as they call them, would be kind of shut down over the time. Cause it was funny. It was just like, you just go in, you walk in, you pay your dollar, and you get, I guess you get as much as you can drink. In some of these places, it was, yeah, it was fascinating.
I'm sure axle grease does a wonderful job on foam retention.
I mean, there was like fish berries and just all this random stuff. And you know, part of the sad thing too is the socioeconomic factor of it was, you know, a lot of poorer and people of minorities were targeted more often than not.
Right.
And I saw that rampantly through. There were so many history articles in the Oklahoman of just, you know, chalk busts. And it was like, it was surprising. So it was a problem, you know, and bootlegging, of course, was going on at this time as well, throughout the state.
Our sponsors, Ricky and Kelly from Groenfell and Havoc Meaderies in Vermont, say the fall seasonal Wild Hunt is now shipping. Wild Hunt is a balanced blend of honey, cranberry, blood orange, and spice brewed in honor of the ceremonial meads of 18th century Northern Europe. At 6.2% ABV, it's deliciously drinkable. And if you search for Wild Hunt on Groenfell.com, you can find a homebrew recipe. So you can pick up some 4-packs of Wild Hunt cans, make the recipe yourself as well, and compare. See how you did. Ricky and Kelly love to support homebrewing and love home mead making, including posting extensive advice and clone recipes on Groenfell.com. So cool. In addition to Wild Hunt, as of this recording, Bourbon Barrel Aged Veneer is still available. It's in a very limited quantity, though. And on the other end of the ABV and flavor spectrum, you can get the delicious honey spritzers as well. Free shipping across the country to most states for orders over $75. That's at family-owned and operated Groenfell.com. That's Groenfell. Even when Prohibition was repealed across the country, the rest of the country, Oklahoma was still behind the times, weren't they?
Right. Yeah. You know, there was, and going back again, there's that whole debate on the intoxicating liquor and what is and what isn't. And, you know, there was still people in government that didn't seem necessary to go full strength and all this and that. So they had, in 1933 it was repealed, and there was a couple of breweries that went online, but they could only do what was known very popular over the time. And even when I came in 2008, that 3-2 beer. Mm-hmm. And so it was people always like, what's that? Well, it means the alcohol by weight, which is really, you know, kind of around 4% or 4.5%.
Right. 4% ABV, 3.2 right. ABW.
Right.
Which correct. Is, which and you can make some good beers. You can make some good beers at that strength.
Sure.
But to be limited to that is kind of constricting.
Right. Right. And because you had a lot of these, again, you had people that are starting these places are mainly from Germany or across from Europe that are used to doing stuff at, you know, 5.5, 6% ABV. And they can't brew to their true original styles. So it's like, what's the freaking point? and so it was bad for business. And, you know, but then obviously Prohibition was back, that was lifted. A lot of, you know, up and coming companies were like, hey, let's at least get in on something. We need to make a drink for Oklahoma. And so there was the Southwestern Brewing Company started up in 1933, eventually got bought out by another larger Chicago brewery. But they had a good run. One of their most popular was the Old King beer. And again, even looking back, trying to find recipes or even how, you know, what it would taste like, it was really tough. Mm. But, you know, again, you look through, the best way was almost through their marketing ads. And I found a lot of those advertisements in the newspapers, which are really cool. And you'll find in the book as well. Just kind of giving you descriptives of, you know, zest and vigor and, you know, things like that, you know, those old time marketing words.
Right. Right.
It was always interesting to me to like, what did it really actually taste like? And could we ever reproduce it? But
I'm assuming that we would refer to it as something similar to the yellow fizzy stuff.
Yeah,
probably. Yeah. Probably didn't get too adventurous back then.
Right. However, I mean, I don't think they were more like the adjunct lagers that you see today. Mm. I think they were probably more traditional. But they did, you know, they did create quite a few, like Pilsner winter beer. You know, then they had old things like Old King New Blend Extra Dry. What even all is that? But there were several places that made Bock beers. You know, those were very popular too in the German drinking culture. So. And then not long after, Progress Brewing Company was kind of a hometown guy that, John Francis Crowdle. So he originally emigrated from Czechoslovakia, which, you know, Czech Republic makes some of the best. They have that Budvar or Czechvar, probably the best. The signature Czech lagers, one of the best, I still think, to these days. And so he created Progress out of Yukon, Oklahoma, and he got pretty big pretty quick. And they actually lasted all the way up until about 1976 when,
wow,
1970s when Lone Star eventually bought them out. But that was a fascinating story too. And there's still some people around today that relatives that I talk to for the stories. It was neat. It's kind of, you know, just like a hometown guy, just going out on his own and you know, really making it in a time where, you know, will this even work? Mm-hmm. kind of.
Yeah, definitely going into an inhospitable environment, staking right. your territory.
Right. And then there was only one other, in about 1938, there was the Aaron's Brewing Company out of Tulsa. So it was kind of Tulsa's first actual brewery, but didn't last very long. It was about only a couple years. They had been founded in like 1935, but only lasted for a few years. And most reports kind of just said they got bullied out pretty quick by other other breweries and possibly the major breweries from, you know, up north. And right. so it's kind of sad to see, but that is kind of Tulsa's claim to their first brewery until they wouldn't get one until 2008.
Yeah, the big boys, Budweiser and such, were making beer for the Oklahoma markets, right? I mean, they they were making the 3-2 beer and selling it in the state. So it's not like it was a, you know, completely dry of
right.
all beer, just the higher ABV beers.
Yeah. And, you know, it couldn't be stored cold. Was it, you know, another factor? Well, I guess, sorry, I didn't even know how they didn't really have like liquor stores back then because, you either get it at a saloon or, you know, a local bar or, I believe at the breweries you could purchase there and take it to go. But, you know, it wasn't like, you know, today with the home packaging because, you know, the other section in here was the 1959 Liquor Control Act, which is the actual time where they fully repealed prohibition in Oklahoma. Now, that doesn't mean the 3-2 beer went away, though. It's like, it's still hanging on. But they did allow for liquor stores was the big thing.
Yeah,
and a big incentive to that was the tax.
Yeah. You know,
getting taxes for schools, tax money for schools. So,
yeah, even when I was in college in the 80s, I would, you know, my friends from Oklahoma would talk about, you know, you couldn't buy some beers cold. You know, you could only buy the weaker beers cold because I guess people, you know, the legislators didn't want you like, you know, getting drunk in the liquor store parking lot or something. I don't know. You know, the reasons for these laws are sometimes, you know, hard to understand.
So again, it got lumped into just beer was just kind of an oversight. Honestly, I mean, after looking at it, it just because eventually wine was allowed, like a wine just kind of skirted through and you had local wineries in Oklahoma that with tasting rooms, but beer couldn't do any of that. Beer was overlooked.
Right. Yeah, up until very fairly recently. But it was the next milestone legislatively, was it was allowing brew pubs? Was that the next major milestone that kind of started kicking things off?
Yeah, exactly. And that wasn't until 1992. So you had to think from 59 to 92. and not until 84, they had the liquor by the wink. You know, you had that going on until 84, where you had your bottle clubs and such. Yeah. So, but yeah, the brew pubs took off pretty well. And then to this day, the only brew pub to, well, not the only, but one of the only, that's still around is, Bricktown Brewery that was formed in downtown Oklahoma City in Bricktown, district. And, they actually carry the first liquor license from, Able Commission, their first brew pub license. And that was the other thing that came out of all that was the Able Commission to actually, you know, control the everything else other than 3.2. So,
And Bricktown was able to expand to other locations, even into Fort Smith, Arkansas.
Yeah, they've recently relocated, and well, not relocated, but they've expanded significantly outside of Oklahoma in several different states. So they've really taken this concept and gone with it.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah.
But even then, even after the even after the brew pub law came about, if you had a brewery, you couldn't give people. You couldn't have a tasting room. You couldn't
right.
serve even free samples, right, to your customers. So if you've got a brewery that's making this new craft beer that people mm-hmm. don't know about, and you're trying to educate them, and they come to the brewery, they can't get a sample of what they have to buy a pig in a poke, so to speak. They have to buy they have to buy beer without tasting it, which seems ridiculous. So when did it get better for breweries as far as being able to serve to customers at their locations?
Backtracking just a little bit with more legislation. So in 2010, a gentleman, Gary Shellman, who is a award-winning home brewer and brewer himself, actually had to help change the laws in Oklahoma and get homebrewing legalized in 2010. Because you could only brew a certain amount for yourself, but we couldn't do enough to where, you know, we had competitions or just, you know, giving out samples to public and things like that, which High Gravity, Dave and Desiree were, you know, very involved in, especially with the local Tulsa chapter, the foam. So it, you know, you had to get over that hurdle first. And then, not until 2013 did we get our tasting laws, and that was kind of spearheaded by the Marshall brothers, Adam and Eric of Marshall Brewing in Tulsa. And with another legislator, they were like, hey, look, we're trying to run a business, and you can't do that with not letting people know what they're trying. So they worked it out to where it was about, I think it was, you get 12 ounces per person per day. And so you can go into a tap room and sample, I guess. You could have 4 3-ounce samples. And, you know, most places only had about 3 to 5 beers probably at the time anyway. But, you know, most people get about 3 to 4 samples of beer, and then they'd be on their way, you know, exit through the gift shop sort of thing. But it was a start, you know. But, yeah, it took that long. It took a while. And Marshall had already been in business for 5 years. 5 years. It's like,
wow.
Just distribution. But they didn't have a lot of local competition either in between that, just a few. But I remember when it happened too. I was there in line just to sample some beer and get the experience. And, you know, like eventually they'd have, like, you know, buy a glass and get a tour of the brewery as well. And so, you know, I kind of caught on with the local people, with the other local breweries and everybody else in towns. So kind of drumming up that craft culture that never really was there.
And still, was the 3-2 beer still a thing at that point?
Yeah, still that. And, you know, so Marshall and Coop and, you know, other places, you know, the very actual first brewery was called Hubert Brewing Company in 2003. I guess I did skip over that. That was actually, he had to change the laws to actually legally have a brewery that distributes beer that it's higher than 3-2. So he actually spearheaded that himself with a local legislator, and eventually you'd have Krebs Brewing that did the chalk beer and went on, you know, Michael Lally's a hell of a brewer himself, and went on to win numerous amounts of awards, which they made some really incredible beers back then, to kind of help put Oklahoma on the map. And, you know, with Marshall coming along and Coop and, you know, there's a Battered Boar up in Edmond, and Mustang Brewing was a big one for a while. you just had more and more places coming on board that, you know, people were like, hey, this, you know, I kind of get it. I get the hype. I like this better than, you know, having to drink 3-2 beer. It gives me more of the kick, so to speak. And you don't have to put axle grease in it. So, but yeah, you know, it's even up until today, it's just the culture is growing right alongside it, but it's so nouveau still. And we also have a new generation of drinkers, but you know, I can get off on a tangent on all that, but yeah, it's been interesting, you know, going from the tasting laws and like more breweries are coming on board because of that. And then, you know, there's more demand. So more places and more cities are wanting to have their own local brewery and like, hey, this is drawing in business for them, but also for other people, because people are wanting to go seek these places out. So it's like, if they're going there, they might come to my restaurant or store, right, or whatever.
Right.
So
there's
a lot more of that going on.
Magnets for commerce.
Right. Right.
It's getting to be fall, and that means cider season is soon to be upon us. Be on the lookout for A40GF Bubbles from our friends and sponsors at Imperial Organic Yeast. Steve and I were talking yesterday about how we need to make some ciders and or sizers, and we're very excited that Bubbles from Imperial is coming soon, later this month. It's gluten-free, which is why it's A40GF. Bubbles is a traditional cider strain, beautiful for fruit juice-based fermentations. The clean profile of the yeast, especially when used at the lower end of the temperature range, allows the nuances of the fruit to be prominent in the finished bubbly beverage. And with a pitch rate of 200 billion cells per easy-to-open package, I like to say my stir plate is dusty because I don't use it anymore to make starters for moderate gravity 5-gallon batches. And my airlocks are usually bubbling before bedtime. Keep an eye out for A40GF Bubbles later this month from Imperial Organic Yeast, coming to your local homebrew store. And check out all the excellent strains available from Imperial at imperialyeast.com. That's imperialyeast.com. I want to talk about the book tells lots of stories, like I say, about homebrewing, about innovation, about sort of working your way up through the ranks, cooperating with other breweries, mm-hmm. contract brewing, you know, and you know, all forms of sort of, you know, building a business, going from home brewer to professional brewer. And one of the examples that probably gives a good indication of how all that works is a fellow that's been on this show a couple times, Chase Healy, who started off as a home brewer, and he told me he started by looking at our home brewing DVDs, which was kind of cool.
Oh, yeah.
But I can't take credit for everything, but you know, maybe his first extract batch, we helped him with that. But he started off as a home brewer and then was a brewer at Coop, right?
Mm-hmm. Correct. Yeah. Yeah, which I don't think a lot of people realized, but he started at Coop when they were up and coming. He was still in school at OU at the time. And yeah, they kind of came up with this idea of, you know, Coop was founded on, you know, we want beers that we like to drink, and we don't really have a whole lot of that here. So they were founded in 2009 and, you know, had some pretty easy drinking, you know, lagers and wheat beers. And they also had the DNR, the Do Not Resuscitate, kind of Belgian quad type beer, and which is still done today. But I think Chase was in there early on, just kind of almost not realizing what to do or how to scale up at that point, but kind of learned as he went, you know. And one of the things that came out of that was him and another brewer that came on board, who is still there, their head brewer to this day, Blake Jarlin, came up with the famous F5 IPA, and still probably one of their best sellers, I think. And yeah, you know, he actually had been, while doing that, went on to actually strike out on his own not too long after. And he actually brewed with Hubert at his place and kind of rented some space there to kind of try his own thing out. And that's kind of where the whole, that was called Redbud Brewing. And that kind of was the beginnings of what would turn into Prairie and then now American Solera, where he was just experimenting. And I think he always had a appreciation for wine and barrel aging. And so that's kind of where he experimented with some wild ales and things of that nature back then. And it's kind of the evolution, you know, his next two companies would be the evolution of that.
Yeah. And he gained national recognition fairly yeah. quickly with his next venture, which was also at another brewery. When he started Prairie, mm-hmm. with working with Michael Lally at Krebs, right? In McAllister. And so still he doesn't have his own standalone brewery, but he's making these amazing mm-hmm. beers that are getting, you know, because he got hooked up with Shelton Brothers, a distributor, and got, you know, on like top 100 beers lists and you know, made beers like The Bomb and, you know, these beers that were really, you know, sort of bending the rules of beers mm-hmm. at the time and getting a lot of national attention. But still not having his own standalone brewery.
Yeah. Well, I, you know, one of the things I think he kind of, idolized is the right word, but, you know, respected other brewers at the time. There was a lot of contract brewing going on because people just didn't have the capital to start their own at that time. And right. he kind of saw the gypsy brewers like McKellar and Evil Twin and guys like that over in Europe, I think, was doing similar styles and similar setups. And they would go around and, you know, gypsy brewer, you go around and you just kind of hang out with other brewers and use their systems to make your own beer and package it there. So, and then distribute it out. But that was kind of his gig for a little while until Prairie eventually, he had enough capital to make the first Prairie Tap Room over in West Tulsa.
And there was at one point a cooperative brewery mm-hmm. that hosted several different breweries until, in typical Oklahoma fashion, I guess it got taken out by a tornado, unfortunately. But that's another, you know, that's another way that people were able to start breweries, not only just right. renting space on, you know, or sharing space at established breweries, but actually sharing this cooperative space, mm-hmm. you know, to sort of get into, you know, get their toe in the water, so to speak, and, you know, on a fairly reasonable financial level. So Chase eventually it wasn't enough that he started amazing, you know, worldwide known brewery in Prairie, but he actually sold that to the Krebs Brewery, right, and moved on to another mm-hmm. venture.
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, over time Prairie just blew up more than he ever expected, and I mean, I've pretty sure I remember him saying that himself. So, you know, he wanted something a little bit smaller and focus more on what he had done before with like wild ales and barrel aging. And I think that's where the American Solera came in, where, you know, the Solera process of aging beers and blending them and was more his speed and wanted to do so. He started that, and that happened pretty close to where the next legislation, you know, was coming around, the 2014-15. There was, you know, drummings of, hey, you know, there's people that want to try and get some better liquor laws and better laws for beer, and you know, that's where we started hearing about, one of the big names in retail, Walmart. You know, they want something, they're gonna go after it and probably most likely get it. So, if we're ready to jump into that, but that's kind of after several more breweries coming online. Tap rooms are kind of flourishing, and people can sample beers here and there. And there's little beer festivals popping up throughout Oklahoma. And but yeah, there's a kind of where the book ends and kind of comes full circle is back with legislation and the new beer boom, I call it, in 2016 of there's a bill being pushed around like, hey, we if you had a wish list of what you would want, what could it be? And obviously everybody wanted to get rid of 3-2 beer, and I'm sure there's people over at Anheuser-Busch too, like, yeah, let's get rid of this finally. And so we had the kind of the I think the first one was the SB 383, and that was done by Stephanie Bice, who's kind of a freshman senator at the time, and kind of get really pushed for cold beer. That was it. I want cold beer that's, I guess you call it High Point or regular strength, right? Cold beer,
right?
In liquor stores and a lot of it was, convenience stores and grocery stores too. So that, and then there's a separate one that was more for the breweries called SB 424 that would amend statutes, allow breweries to sell full strength, both on and off premise for consumption. So that was the big deal there. And so those went into effect, and the actual, the brewers, the 424 actually went into effect in 2016. And then the full, cold beer went into effect in 2018. So that's when we had like the big, big push through of that. So that's when everything changed is in 2018. But, breweries were gung-ho and ready to go. Like, oh yeah, I can. They were already making a lot of that beer for either the tap room or for samples, or, distributing it themselves in cans or bottles. So it wasn't much, but just, freeing the taps and letting them go. And that's what happened.
And we went to the Tulsa Craft Beer Invitational last year, and there was a lot of breweries there, and lots of really good, interesting, fun beers as well. So it looks like is Oklahoma there? are there any other hurdles that Oklahoma needs to get over, or is it pretty much friendly territory now?
Yeah, I mean, in regards to beer, it, as far as, the nitty gritty when you get to distribution and things of that nature, it's sort of there. Originally, you could only distribute beer 8.99% and under, but I think that's recently changed. I can't recall exactly, but it's not like most people were, that stuff's usually best left warm and in liquor stores or at the brewery and special released, and not something you really need people to go out to the grocery store and get. So that was okay. But I think one of the big things that a lot of people didn't understand or realized, we had a lot of local festivals and their big cash cow was 3-2 beer. And because it wasn't, it was taxed differently and considered a food product, they could sell it on the streets and, at these festivals, gated and obviously and all this stuff, but that all went away. So they couldn't do anything else. So a lot of these little festivals just stopped. So it kind of hurt the local economy a little bit in that sense. And yeah, it put a damper on it, because I used to go with my business to, one big one was the Blue Dome Arts Festival, and it had tons of local artists and bands and things of that nature, and really brought a huge crowd. But I mean, their main revenue stream was alcohol sales. And so once that went away, it was like, oh, we can't do that anymore. So, you know, I think there's things like that that still need to change. And we are, you know, much better off with the new guild that is, you've talked to Tabby Burwell over there in Oklahoma City recently, and things she's doing for that, for them, has been great to see and much needed. And they do a lot of lobbying and trying to make sure the legislation is good for breweries and they're not paying too many taxes and all the stuff the public probably doesn't see, you know, on a daily basis. But it's, as far as beer, I think, yeah, we're there. You know, just recently I learned that Walmart again is trying to push for liquor sales in their stores. So we're now going to go after that hurdle, I guess. So that's interesting. But yeah, you know, there's still room for growth here. There's so many different breweries, but everybody's just doing their own thing that it works so well and no one's really stepping on toes. And there's still a lot of really great collaboration and, you know, everybody's doing slushies and, hey, you know, triple IPAs and the haziest thing you've ever seen, IPA, and most amazing German styles, and then foraged beers, you know, from like Heirloom. And then it's not just Tulsa, Oklahoma City. It's, you know, 3 hours south in Beaver's Bend, or it's, you know, I just did some branding and for a place called Long Bell Brewing out in Clinton, Oklahoma, pretty much right on the border next to Texas over there near the panhandle. So it's spanning all corners of the state, and it's, you know, it's in definitely high demand still to these days.
Well, excellent. It's a fascinating story, and it's good to know that y'all have come a long way. It's kind of embarrassing when Arkansas was a more progressive state than when you're behind Arkansas in anything legislative wise.
Yeah, the one thing to compare to that, I think you guys still have dry counties, and I think we finally actually got rid of all of ours.
Oh yeah, about last because, time I looked, it was about half. About half of the counties in Arkansas are dry, but but some are moistening up, so to speak. But yeah, we've got a ways to go as well. Well, Oklahoma Beer is the book, A Handcrafted History, and it's a fascinating book and very, as far as I can tell, a pretty complete history of beer in the state. And come see us at the you know, Steve and I are planning to be at the Tulsa Craft Beer Invitational as of this recording next weekend, if you're listening to this. So come on down to Tulsa and hang out in the parking lot with us and see Brian in his natural environment. I appreciate it. It's been fun.
Yeah, likewise. It's been great talking to you. Always good to talk about beer, no matter what time of day.
Well, thanks again to Brian. Looking forward to seeing Brian in person at the Tulsa Craft Beer Invitational this Saturday in the parking lot of highgravitybrew.com. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. Please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. In the meantime, stay well and stay tuned. So long.